So a number of years ago, a fellow in my previous parish, who many years before had worked very closely with a large and prominent, wealthy, family-run steel company. And he was telling me how pleased he was that this company had recently managed to make its way through the transition from the children of the founder to the grandchildren of the founder. And they'd gone through some rough and bumpy times. But the transition had finally worked itself out, and the company was doing really well. And my friend pointed out that it often seems, when you look at family-owned businesses, it often seems that it's the third generation that kills it and runs it into the ground. Because the second generation is usually closely connected with the first, with whoever started the business. And they share the values. Those values have been instilled in them, the values that made the company great and built it. But it's often the third generation. These are the kids who grew up living off the company profits without the experience of running the business. And so when the company is handed to them, oftentimes family squabbles or inexperience or a loss of those founding values often is what brings the company down. Now, I say that because the second half of Genesis 25, which is what we'll be looking at today, this part of the chapter brings us to the third generation of this family venture of faith that God has called Abraham into. And as the storyteller introduces this new generation to us, we see God's promises once again put in jeopardy. It seems like God made these promises, and each of these stories shows us something that's getting in the way. This time it's compromised, or it's put in jeopardy by family conflict and by personal character flaws in this third generation. So once again, God's covenant, is it going to happen? It's in jeopardy. And of course, the real underlying point of the story is to show God at work, to bring his promises to pass, overcoming obstacles, turning conflict into peace, and shaping character through the sanctifying influence of his grace. And all of that to make sure that the promises he has made will come to pass despite the failings of all the people he works through. So we begin with verse 19. And verse 19 begins the story or the account of the generations of Isaac. Now, we've seen these are the generations of, we've seen this come up before. Because that's the phrase that the storyteller uses to break up Genesis into its segments, into each of its main divisions, and each of the family stories. The account of the generations of Noah, for example, told us about his descendants, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then we read about the account of the generations of Terah, which then tells us the story of his son Abraham. So the account of the generations of Isaac tells us the story of Isaac's sons, Jacob and Esau. Now, what's interesting is that there is no account of the generations of Abraham. That would tell us Isaac's story. Instead, the storyline goes straight from Abraham to Jacob. The only thing in between, which is really strange, is that there is a little tiny subdivision, we looked at it last week, the generations of Ishmael, who was Isaac's natural brother, the spiritual dead end. What little we're told about Isaac is either incorporated into the story of his father Abraham, or it's incorporated into the story of Jacob. And it's really odd, considering that Genesis tells us about the generation of Ishmael, that spiritual dead-end brother. And yet it doesn't have a separate segment for Isaac. Now, Genesis itself doesn't give us any direct answers as to why this would be. It's not that Isaac's life was uneventful or that he was unimportant, because he was very important. I mean, if we think back, his early life was centered on his miraculous birth, and then we had that wonderful story of his near sacrifice and God's rescue of him just as Abraham was about to put the knife into his heart. And then in his midlife, we read about the evidence of God's providence at work, especially as God provided him with Rebekah as a wife. And in chapter 26, the next chapter, when I get back from holidays, we'll get into that. We'll see God assure Isaac of his blessings that he had promised to his father through him, that would be worked out through him. And yet, as the story goes on, Isaac becomes an old man, And as we see him becoming an old man, we see him starting to play favorites with his sons. And he lets conflict fester in his family. And we see him refusing to submit to God's plans. So Genesis may pass over Isaac's story simply because he failed to remain faithful. He started out very faithful, but his faith seemed to have petered out as he got older. He failed to walk in his father's footsteps. So it's telling that after Isaac's attempts to thwart God's election and blessing of Jacob, he disappears completely from the story until we hear about his death, which is like 10 chapters away from this. But whatever the case, the story of Isaac's sons begins at verse 19. So we read there, "These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived." So there's some parallels here. Think about it. Abraham was 75 years old when he received God's promise of a son and relocated to Canaan. But Sarah was barren for another 25 years before Isaac was miraculously born. Now that same pattern follows in Isaac's life. He marries at the age of 40, but Rebekah remains barren for 20 years, almost as long as Sarah. So it's funny, barrenness, infertility, could only run in a family when God is at work. Infertility doesn't run in families, but it does when God is at work. Just as Abraham was patient and waited on God, so does Isaac. The story of Sarah's barrenness was full of uncertainty and concern, and it took 9 chapters to work out that barrenness problem. In contrast, Rebekah's barrenness lasts almost as long, 20 years versus 25, but in terms of Genesis, in terms of the text, it's worked out in one verse. So we can probably read everything we were told about Sarah's barrenness and her concern for that. We can probably read all of that into Rebekah's story, into this verse. But we do see that Isaac seems to have learned from the mistakes of his parents. Think back, Abraham and Sarah took matters into their own hands. And Abraham fathered Ishmael by Sarah's servant Hagar. So, well, God promised a son. It's been all these years, I haven't had one yet, so maybe we should go do this earthly thing to make it happen. And of course, it led to all sorts of trouble. And Isaac could probably, no doubt, remember the conflict that situation had brought into his family. At the very least, he would have remembered how Ishmael had teased him and made fun of him and then been sent away by his father into the wilderness. So Abraham had been patient in the face of Sarah's barrenness, but he wasn't perfectly patient. And it caused problems. So now Isaac, instead of taking matters into his own hands, he intercedes for his wife. He prays for Rebekah. He puts his faith in God's ability to bring about what he had promised. Just as Sarah's barrenness had been Rebekah's, just as Sarah's barrenness had been an opportunity for God to demonstrate his power and his faithfulness in her life, Rebekah's barrenness shows that he is sovereignly at work, teaching her, teaching Isaac to trust him, to provide. I like the way my Old Testament professor from seminary put it, Bruce Waltke. He says, barrenness here is not an occasion for anxiety, but for sovereign grace. Often the things come up in our lives and we become anxious about them. Next time you become anxious about some situation, stop and think. This isn't an opportunity for me to practice being anxious. We don't need practice at that. Let it be an opportunity to learn something about God's sovereign grace. He says, barrenness here is not an occasion for anxiety, but for sovereign grace. This generation also has to learn the lessons of faith and to understand that theirs is not a natural, but a supernatural seed. So Rebekah's barrenness should be a reminder to us that God's goal is to draw us closer to himself. And his greater goal in general is to show forth his glory to his creation. This is what we tend to forget. Someone was telling me recently that, well, if we aren't seeing God's promises fulfilled in our lives, or if we aren't fully healthy, or if we aren't living prosperously, it's only because we lack faith. But brothers and sisters, we need to remember that God is far more concerned about our eternal state than he is with the state of our perishing bodies or our earthly prosperity. If allowing us to struggle faithfully and patiently through hardship and sorrow and privation will teach us to trust him more fully and to draw close to him, God will often allow us to struggle faithfully and patiently through hardship and sorrow and privation. And if we aren't seeing the fulfillment of God's promises, it's not because we lack faith. As we see throughout Scripture, God's promises are fulfilled not because of our faith, not because we are faithful, but because he is faithful. Because it's part of his character that what he says he will do despite us. God will fulfill every one of his own promises in his own way and in his own timing. He is sovereign over his creation. So we need to remember that. And Rebecca's barrenness becomes an opportunity for this new generation in Genesis to learn the lesson. So this is exactly what we see as a result of Rebecca's barrenness. Isaac knew God's promise. Isaac knew that God was sovereign. I mean, he was himself, consider his own story, his own background that he no doubt knew. His parents had told him, "You're the miraculous kid who came when I was 100 years old and your mother was 99. Isaac knew how God worked. He was an example of God's sovereign and miraculous provision. And so instead of worrying and becoming anxious, instead of sleeping with Rebekah's maid in order to get the son that he knew should come, Isaac takes his concerns to God in prayer. He goes to the one who made the promise in the first place and whom he knows controls the situation. So childlessness becomes an opportunity to exercise faith in God. And of course, the lesson learned, God allows Rebekah to conceive. And he does it in his own timing. We don't know if Isaac was praying for 20 years or if he prayed for 19 years and 364 days. And we don't know, but he was praying and interceding for his wife. And the lesson learned, she became pregnant. It's a fitting way for the story of Jacob to begin. So if Abraham's story was primarily about faith, Jacob's story is primarily about sovereign election and calling by God. And so Rebecca's pregnant, but now it's her turn to pray. If you're following along, you can look at verses 22 and 23. It says, the children struggled within her. And she said, if it is thus, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. And two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the other shall serve the younger. So first off, when God answers Isaac's prayer, he does it abundantly. Rebecca isn't just pregnant. Isaac isn't just going to have one son, because all he really needs is one son. No, she gets pregnant, and she's got twins now. So God doesn't do anything with a stingy hand. He's abundant. And yet, as the twins grow, she becomes troubled at this violent conflict that's going on in her womb. I mean, literally, the twins were struggling, kicking and shoving within her. And the violent struggle of the babies is so great that she decides to seek an explanation and probably assurance from God that everything's okay. The text of Genesis doesn't give us the details. Maybe she went to one of Abraham's or Isaac's altars to pray. She may have sought out a priest from one of the towns or villages nearby. Again, we don't know the specifics, but she inquires of God and God speaks. And he tells her that the conflict in her womb foreshadows the conflict that will exist between her two sons and their descendants. In doing that, God first confirms the fulfillment of his promise that Abraham would be the father of nations. and one particularly great nation out of those. Through the seed of Abraham's miraculous son, God would create a people through whom he would work out his plan of redemption. God confirms that again. And so as Isaac's conception and birth, as Isaac's conception and birth were seen by Abraham and Sarah as part of the fulfillment of God's promise, the conception of these twin boys is seen by Isaac and Rebekah as the continuing fulfillment of that same promise that God had given. But God also throws them a curve. He hasn't given one nation here, he's given two. And as they strive with each other in the womb, they will strive with each other in the world. And yet, this isn't the rebellious striving of the second son for the rightful natural inheritance of the first, the older brother. No, God sovereignly decrees, and this seems to be where the conflict comes from, God sovereignly decrees that before these boys are even born, the older shall serve the younger. Even before they're born, he turns these two boys upside down in terms of who they will be and how they will function and relate to each other. Genesis teaches something about election here. When God elects and when God calls us, it's not based on our standing in family or our standing in society. It's not based on anything we've done to deserve it. He declared to Rebekah, "The older shall serve the younger." God chose Jacob, the younger twin. And he did it against every societal and cultural convention of that day. By all rights, Esau, the firstborn, should have inherited God's covenant blessings and promises. But God instead bypasses those cultural expectations, and he chooses the younger son. As we'll see in the story of these two men, God didn't choose Jacob because he was somehow more worthy than Esau. Right from the start, both of these boys are painted in a negative light. And it doesn't get any better as they grow up. God's election is completely independent of our merit. As St. Paul writes in Romans, he says of Jacob and Esau, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of him who calls, she was told, the older shall serve the younger. Paul also wrote to the Ephesians saying that God's election is according to the purposes of his will. And while the will of God and election remains a mystery to us, why Jacob? Why not Esau? Why us? Why not people out there in the world whom he hasn't called? We can be certain that also, as Paul writes in Ephesians, God works all things according to the counsel of his will. So despite how it may look to us, there is nothing arbitrary about God and how he works or whom he chooses to work through. When we can't understand what God is doing, the one thing Scripture certainly teaches us is that God works all things to bring out what is good, to bring about what is good for his people and what ultimately will display his glory to his creation. We need to trust him. In his will is our peace. Even if we don't know what it is, we can rest in it and be at peace. Now, eventually the twins were born. But these were no identical twins. Right from the start, they're very different, as we read in verses 24 to 26. When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. Now, those names, Jacob and Esau, don't mean anything to us in English. This is one of the places where it's kind of nice to get into the Hebrew and you can see the connections. But we have to understand I mean, sometimes we give our children names and we try to pick something that sounds nice, or sometimes, especially in some religious traditions, even amongst Christians, we try to pick names that say something about God or our hopes for our child in terms of their relationship with God and things like that. But we don't go to the effort that people in the ancient world did. They gave their names, they were very thoughtful about their names. And they intended the names to say something either about the gods they worshipped, or it was often common for the names to be a commentary on the circumstances of the child's birth, or an expression of the hope and the expectations the parents had for the child. And, of course, if the parents were clever, they could incorporate multiple aspects of all these things into that name. And that's what we see here. Now, when it comes to Esau, unfortunately, our knowledge of Hebrew with that particular name has been lost, and we don't know exactly what the connection was between the word Esau and the word Harry, and we don't know really what Esau meant in terms of, you know, how that might relate to a religious context. The name Jacob, on the other hand, we can tell a lot about. Was actually a fairly common name in that language and in that culture. It means may God protect. So in naming Jacob, Isaac and Rebekah were recognizing God's hand on him. They were recognizing God's divine election of him. And yet, at the same time, the name is a play. In Hebrew, it's Yaakov, and it's a play on the word Akav, which means to seize somebody by the heel or to go behind somebody to betray them. So in Jacob, we can assume Esau's name is the same. We just don't know what it means anymore. But Jacob's name, it expresses God's providence in his life, and it also is a commentary on the circumstances where he was born grasping Esau's heel. Now, while Jacob and Rebekah no doubt intended these names to be positive, both names foreshadow the characters that these men will become. I mean, both names were no doubt as descriptive as Jacob when it came to Isaac's desire to see God at work, building faith in his sons and working out his promises. And yet, knowing where the story will go, we as the audience can't help but notice that Isaac and Rebekah have appropriately named their little boys Harry Monster and Backstabber. They're oblivious to this at this point. But knowing where the story goes, we can't help but notice that. It helps if you can see the Hebrew and how the Hebrew works out. And this becomes all the more apparent as the boys grow up. In verses 27 and 28, we read, "When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob." So Esau became an outdoorsman. Here Mr. Red and Harry becomes a redneck. He spends his time hunting and fishing. And as we'll see in chapter 27, he looked and he smelled like a man who was always out hunting and fishing. From a biblical perspective, though, it's not a very favorable description. Again, Bruce Waltke describes it this way. He says, "While the law made provision for eating game, hunting, the biblical writers commend pastoralists and condemn predators." Think back. Nimrod, the founder of the cities that stood opposed to God, is identified as a mighty hunter. Later, Esau is described as one who lives by the sword. The biblical ideal for a leader is symbolized by that of a shepherd. True Israel, like his God, behaves like a shepherd, not a hunter. Now, Jacob, in stark contrast, stays in the camp. He's not the hunting and fishing guy. But his description is no more favorable. Our translation, the ESV, translates the Hebrew saying that Jacob grew up and was a quiet man. And the Hebrew word is very difficult. It doesn't occur in this type of context in any other place, really. Normally, it means perfect. But here, it's most likely referring to Jacob growing up to be a civilized or a cultured guy, which stands in stark contrast to Esau, who's the wild, hairy man who's always out running through the woods or the desert hunting game. So Esau grows up to be sort of a man's man. He's rough and tumble. He thought only for the day, but he was honest and he was straightforward. In contrast, Jacob grew up into a civilized and cultured young man. Instead of getting out and getting his hands dirty like his brother, he stays in the camp. As his father got older, he might have taken over the job of, you know, overseeing the slaves and the hired hands who cared for the family's flocks and herds. Maybe he was the bookkeeper and kept track of the numbers. But where Esau thought only for the day and was honest in his dealings, and we'll see more of that in the chapters to come, where Esau was honest but thought only for the day, Jacob was making plans for the future and was secretly scheming to bring them about. So not only are they two very different types of men, but then their parents, they fed the conflict between them by playing favorites. Isaac favored Esau, which doesn't reflect well on Isaac. It says he liked Esau better because Esau made the food he liked to eat. And Rebekah favored Jacob. And their favoritism sets up for the story we'll read in chapter 27. Isaac was not willing to accept God's election of Jacob. And so in chapter 27, he manipulates events to bless Esau instead. And of course, Rebekah's favoring of Jacob leads to this deceptive plot we'll read about in order to slip. Most of you know the story, I imagine, and she had Jacob masquerade as his brother and put goat skin on his arms, and she makes food that she knows Isaac will like and slips Jacob in and has him pretend to be Esau. Instead of letting God pass the covenant on to Jacob, she schemes and is with this dishonest scheme to slip her son in to make sure that what God had promised would come to pass. Now, the story of the birth of Jacob and Esau is a story of God's sovereignty, and it's a story of his mercy, and it teaches us the need to depend completely on him. He's the one who is always at work to bring about his will and to fulfill his promises. So we've seen this over and over already, so we're just seeing more of it here. But while Abraham and Sarah were scheming to bring about the son of promise through her maid Hagar, God was planning the miraculous reinvigoration of both Abraham and Sarah in their old age so that they would have a supernatural son. And even as Isaac was a young man, we saw God at work far away in Padan Aram providing a future bride for him. And as Abraham's servant arrived at that well in that faraway place, who was it who ensured that servant would encounter just the right girl for Isaac? God was working it all out as we read with the children this morning. And here is the twins' struggle in Rebekah's womb. God has already made his sovereign decree that Jacob, the younger, will be the heir of the covenant. God is always at work. And to top it off, God works according to his own purposes. We see that particularly in his bypassing of the natural son Ishmael by providing a supernatural heir in Isaac. And in this case, we see him naming and calling not the first son, Esau. That's the one who custom and his position in the family dictated that he would be the heir, but God calls the second son, Jacob, instead. And none of it's based on merit. As Jesus tells us in St. John's Gospel, he said, "You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you." That's the same principle at work going back to Jacob. And that tells us something. God is sovereign, but in his sovereignty, he is also incredibly merciful. He doesn't choose us because of our merit or because we deserve to be chosen. If that were the case, no one would ever be deserving of God's calling. No, he calls his people, even as they walk in rebellion, even as their lives are characterized by the sorts of flaws that we've seen in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Esau. God doesn't call righteous men and women. He calls sinners. He calls the humble and the lowly. He even calls backstabbers. And then he turns them into righteous men and women. And so, brothers and sisters, in the knowledge that God is sovereign and that God is merciful, we then ought to be driven to total dependence on Him. Despite what the world may tell us, there are no guarantees outside of the will and purpose of God. Being a firstborn son is no guarantee of privilege if God wills otherwise. Samuel's mother, another child born thanks to prayer and the mercy of God, when he was born, Hannah, his mother, declared in a song of praise to God, "The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world." Think about so many of the examples we can find in the scriptures. In his sovereignty, he cast Saul, the great king, from his throne, and he lifted up David, the humble shepherd boy, to his place. In his sovereignty, he chose and called Saul of Tarsus, his greatest opponent and one of the chief persecutors of the early church. And he called and chose Saul of Tarsus, who changed his name to Paul. And in doing that, God turned his zeal and passion to the gospel and made him the great apostle to the Gentiles. Dear friends, it is God who gives in his grace and according to his will. So let us depend on him. Let us steep ourselves in his word that we might know his promises, and then wait on him patiently in faith, sure in the knowledge, as Paul says, that for those who love him, all things work for good, for those who were called according to his purpose. Would you pray with me? Sovereign God, thank you for calling us to yourself. Give us grace to live in faith, knowing that your election and calling are sure. When things look bad from our perspective, remind us that you are always working things out for good in our lives. When we struggle to wait for the fulfillment of your promises, give us grace to be patient and remind us that you are eternally faithful. Grant these things, we pray, for the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.